that just motivates us to continue to create something special that developers can really use to change the world.
What parts of this development process do you still believe needs human touch?
When you're more focused on helping others be great and achieve things together with others, that's when you unlock something that's really special.
How do you guys decide what to open source versus what not to?
We feel a huge sense of responsibility to support individual developers and students and startups and enterprises so that they can solve the problems that are most important to them and their companies.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Zero to One. Our guest today is Janine Banks, a powerhouse in tech and developer innovation. She is the VP and GM of Developer X and Developer Relations at Google, where she helps shape how developers around the world interact with platforms such as Flutter and Firebase. With a strong background in computer science, an MBA, and leadership roles at IBM, AWS, and Google, Janine brings deep experience in both technology as well as community. Today, she's here to share her journey and what it really means to lead in tech and the tools and mindsets that have helped her make a lasting impact. So yeah, welcome, Janine. We're really excited to have you here.
I'm glad to be here too.
First question, this is more like for the audience to get to know you. As a VP at Google, what does a typical day in your life look like? This could be like in at work, like outside of work, hobbies. Yeah, we just want to know more about what your day looks like.
Well, it starts early, and it starts early, but not fast. You know, have some hot tea or coffee in the morning, be able to catch up on some news, look at what I'm doing throughout that day and even for the next day. So I work with a global team. So at different times around the clock, we have different team members that are online. So I'll connect in the morning in my time zone, you know, with our colleagues that are in Asia, you know, from India to our teams in China and Japan. Once I'm sort of getting myself together and like set up for the day for the specific work I want to do, definitely there are meetings that we do. But like I said, early is my only meetings. I like to carve out time for thinking, time for ad hoc conversations with people or questions, and which I do a lot with folks. I'll just, you know, send a message and say, hey, can we jump on and or can we brainstorm this thing? Or I have an idea I woke up thinking about. And so I'll do that. I do a lot of writing proposals, writing communications, writing plans, requirements. There's also a big part of my day. It's super important to me that if not every single day, multiple times every week, I'm talking with our users. And so those are developers, those are customers at companies. And I'm always engaged with our users directly. Usually it's about the experiences that we're providing and getting feedback. And then another part of my day is responding to escalations that come up.
Putting out fires.
Fires, you know, something's always coming up. I'm a huge reader. I love to read. When I'm not doing any of the things I just said, I'm soaking in knowledge from reading, from watching. Definitely, I'm an avid YouTube consumer of content. And then the other thing is I learn by doing. So I use our products regularly. So again, speaking of Firebase Studio, I built like 3 or 4 apps this past weekend. And I've been sharing it with our internal chat rooms and my external networks, getting feature requests and trying to turn around the next releases. So I've already been able to burn down some feature requests that came in from my little apps that I built. One of them was an app for predicting if there would be hail weather in your area or a particular area. So you could sort of like predict that using Gemini and also pull in the latest news on the weather. Another app that I worked on was an inspiration from a friend of mine. I was at a gathering and they said, you know, I want an app that teaches me how to play the piano. So I said, okay, that's what we're gonna literally put that in, that prompt into the app prototyping agent in Firebase Studio. We did. We had an app 10 minutes later. And I've already added like 5 more features that came in from a feature request.
That's awesome.
So that Now it also has violins. I had to change the name. I had to change the name of the app because piano was in the name. And now I just call it like Melody.
I know people struggle to build apps, takes weeks and weeks. So the fact that you can build 4 apps so fast is A, like amazing, and also B, perfect example of like being able to use your own product and iterate on it. We hear you studied computer science during your undergrad and then went on to pursue an MBA in general management, if I'm not mistaken. That's quite a unique combination. So what really motivated you?
Thank you. Yeah, it was actually funny because it's the second switch. So what I mean by that is I had the opportunity to start college while I was in high school still. So my 10th grade year in secondary school, I was able to qualify for a special effort to introduce students to the intermodal transportation field. And so there was a partnership between my high school and Dowling College, which was not too far away from the school. And they wanted to advance the field, this whole idea of transportation systems being connected, whether it's land, sea, the air, and everything in between, to modernize and transform urban centers, as well as how you connect urban and rural communities together, improving economies, improving education access, and so on. So this was a field that I did not think I was going to be going into. Mm-hmm. But basically, this program, this partnership meant that anyone in the partnership was going to be majoring in that. So I started at Dowling as a student. I was part of a cohort of maybe 10 to 15 students that started this program. And within a couple of months, I was the only student left.
Wow. That's kind of crazy.
You know, I found it interesting, but I was not convinced that was going to be my career choice. And I had some previous exposure in STEM as a kid and as when I was in junior high school. So I knew I wanted to do something with computers. So by the time I graduated high school, after being in this program, I chose to reboot, choose a new major and major in computer science. And so while I was able to carry some credits along from my earlier years in school, I essentially almost started over and majored in computer science.
Technical computer science degree. What made you realize like, oh, I think an MBA is the right decision for me?
At the time, so the internet was exploding. And I don't know, 10th grade was a really pivotal year in high school because I also did an internship that summer at Brookhaven National Laboratory. And I had a chance to learn programming through that internship and specifically building websites. So once I kind of started my computer science degree, I was also doing consulting on the side, helping to build web applications, websites for companies. Then when I graduated, I got a full-time job, you know, as a software engineer. I was at a financial software company in New York. My job was basically to help integrate our company software with banking systems of our customers. We have banks, but I saw that we were repeating the same integrations over and over. So there was also some selfishness in that because I was like, this job is going to be boring. I'm doing the same thing over and over again. So like, how do we reinvent this job? But there was someone who was a VP at that company, and he was gracious enough to give me advice on my proposal that I wrote. And lo and behold, the proposal got funded to build a team. But then I realized like, that was pretty cool. Basically, like building a product and a technical product. This seems like something I want to do, but I had a hunch from that experience and getting the advice on my proposal that there were some skills that I didn't have on the business side. And so that's what made me want to go back to school and get a business degree, things like that.
So you always knew you wanted to be go from, you know, an individual contributor role to, you know, more of a manager role. And that's what basically pushed you to that MBA program, right?
Yeah, I would say before starting my MBA, but the inspiration to go pursue it wasn't that I saw myself going into management per se. It was more that I saw myself having the freedom to build things that users and customers needed. And I thought skills like, how do I come up with a business model? How do I promote, you know, engage users and get them excited about this? How do I define the roadmap? And how do I build this out? What to build first? How do you prioritize that? It wasn't until I started. And so going through that experience actually is what got me thinking about leadership and got me thinking about not just understanding business, but building a business and running a business.
So I guess your MBA experience kind of influenced your leadership style and just like really motivated you to want to be in a position of leadership. Very cool. And I know a lot of our listeners also are often asking like, what do I do after a computer science degree? Is an MBA the right choice for me? So I'm sure a lot of people can learn from this journey.
One of the things I always advise or mentor people is whatever educational opportunity you might consider, be purposeful about it, because not every pursuit is for every person. I know super successful people that don't have degrees in anything. They have amazing life experience. They have amazing risk-taking tolerance, and they have support systems around them that stretch them and challenge them. So not everything is for everyone. There's not one path. As you evaluate those options, really just think about what is it that you would like to get out of it and how it helps you achieve other goals that you have.
So for students specifically that are, you know, majoring in computer science, doing their undergrad in CS, that are interested to go the startup route after they graduate, what do you think are the skills that they should be focusing on during college?
I think that this whole notion of starting a company, it's actually a different question that we should ask ourselves is, you know, it's really about this degree of risk-taking, this degree of really wanting to have a lot of responsibility. Because as a startup founder myself, you really are not just laser focused on your product. You are wearing 20 different hats and you're really kind of digging in and trying and experimenting with many different things. So it's really like the degree of risk that you're willing to take, the control and the ability to have a lot of responsibility across multiple areas, I think is a key consideration. That's not necessarily for everyone. Many people perfectly enjoy and do well going deep in fewer areas versus having a large breadth. And it's really this notion of like, do you have a passion for solving problems that others haven't solved or haven't solved as well? Do you? And so do you want others to bet on you and a startup that you might want to create, but you're not really betting on yourself? I'm an angel investor. And when I look at startups that I'm in founders, it's really about that founder and how much they're betting on themselves and the vision that they have for the future.
Can you tell us a little bit about your experience? I know you have like a range of startups that you kind of like worked with.
My eldest son, he was born with a host of different health issues. And so that was something new that my husband and I had to learn, but our first child. And at the time, there just weren't many options for treatment. Clinical trials hadn't been done for children so young with those conditions. It was just so complex navigating the healthcare system. But then there was also sort of the personal and social side of it. It was difficult for my son to be able to find and keep good friendships because, or even just playmates, because of his health issues were visible. And so sometimes other children would just be afraid of what he's going through, not realizing he's not contagious, but just afraid of what they don't know. And so that really got me thinking that wouldn't it be cool if there was some way for parents who have children with health issues to be able to form play groups amongst our children so that our children could find more kids that are more like them or dealing with challenges like they are, who could be more understanding, but just see them as kids. So that was the first company or idea that I had for a startup. And that journey of going down that path of every single detail from writing that idea down to talking to other parents that I knew with children suffering from health conditions and learning from them and kind of getting their requirements and testing it out, putting this idea together and building the initial software that they could preview, everything from, you know, trying to find partnerships, maybe daycares or schools that could like be a referral channel for our company. Everything with the brand and marketing and advertising, it was just every single decision. And so that experience of where you suddenly go from hyper-focused on the problem you want to solve, the product you want to build, to now suddenly you have these larger questions of, okay, how am I going to get people using this? Where are my users at? How do I reach them? How do I communicate to them? And then this is healthcare, which is regulated and or even touches on health in some way. And so that can be a sensitive topic. How do you overcome privacy and things like that? And so that was my first foray into startup life.
You know, recently I've started like cutting angel tickets as well. And I just talk to founders on X, on LinkedIn, anywhere I can. Founders who have, you know, lived the problem firsthand, who have experienced, you know, living this problem is definitely a plus. And, you know, just building with I guess a purpose is also something I'm looking into specifically.
That drive, like you said, and that personal experience resulted in me building two other startups and branching off from that initial idea. So we went from the idea of playgroups for kids with chronic health conditions to the next idea was like, oh, social is becoming a thing. We can bring these social groups that are offline more fully online and create like a health social network. Then that branched into, okay, not just kids and not just social network, but what's the business model for this? And then there's like connection between this, the data and insights that the user generated content and how other industries and adjacent organizations could benefit from that and would be interested in valuing that. So like clinical research organizations or pharmaceutical companies, medical device providers, healthcare providers. So started to think pharmacies, started to think about the whole ecosystem around the members of our particular health social network.
Your journey kind of went from startups to big tech, which I'm assuming is also a lot more focused. Your role is a lot more clear. Now at Google, you're driving developer tools used by millions of people. So I believe you're driving like Flutter, Firebase. Just thinking about that switch, even from like AWS to Google, it's a massive, massive shift. So what changed in how you approached innovation and also product strategy across such different environments?
Wow. Listening to you kind of recount some of those things is pretty cool. I feel so grateful for the opportunity that I have here at Google. Our team, DeveloperX, we are a global group of folks that are eager to serve developers, essentially helping them to be able to get the most out of their relationship with Google, but also to be able to be as effective and productive as possible, building the platforms and systems that their companies need. And so with that, we actually have two jobs. We run the Cross Google Developer Experience and programs. So for example, the Google Developer Program is our flagship effort to connect the dots across Google's products and PAs so that developers can use them seamlessly with a consistent way of engaging with Google. We also run communities of and programs and startup accelerators. But you mentioned some of the products that we manage, which I've just been ecstatic for the opportunity to be able to work with the teams. Many of them are founders of these products. So we have Google's first party languages like the Go language and Dart language. It's been a pleasure kind of seeing how those languages have grown over the years and the amazing, brilliant minds behind them. And then, like you said, we have the Firebase platform, which is really, a lot of people don't realize it's like 22, 25 different services. The most recent one we introduced at Cloud Next recently called Firebase Studio. And then we have the Flutter framework. And so as we work on these different areas and different technologies, we feel a huge sense of responsibility to support from individual developers and students and startups and enterprises, everyone in between, to be able to meet them at the right place and time so that they can solve the problems that are most important to them and their companies.
I'm just curious, like, how do you stay focused and aligned while overseeing such diverse teams?
What all those areas have in common is focusing on helping developers to be successful. It's a wide space, and I think that is really important to have a clear North Star for what success looks like. Because you could do any number of things at any time, but how do you know you're making progress? How do you know that you're having the impact that you could have or that you want to have? And so one thing that we do as a team is we have a North Star, which unifies the whole team around it. The second thing that we do is we are wholeheartedly, believers and followers of having clear, measurable OKRs. And so we define our OKRs. We do annual, but then we also look at OKRs on a quarterly basis, not just looking at the performance of different metrics, but, you know, what we increasingly try to do and we want to get even better at is being a learning organization. So instilling the practice of retrospectives in everything that we do so that we're continuing to take a look back to learn from what we've done, whether it went well or it didn't go so well. And then on a day-to-day basis, where I spend my time personally is both shaped by that, but also a big part of it is sort of running our organization and creating a workplace and an environment that people feel really welcomed in. People feel like they can solve hard problems and be challenged and grow. And then also ultimately feel connected to something that's empowering and inspiring.
I've always been passionate about, you know, building apps. I've been doing this in college, after college. And obviously I've been interacting, you know, with Google DevTools a lot, you know, ranging from, you know, open source ones, you know, like TensorFlow to closed source, you know, tools. What you think in general about, you know, open source tools versus closed source tools? I guess, how do you guys decide what to, you know, open source versus what not to?
Absolutely. I'm glad you bring up the subject of open source, because I think it's probably the one area that I didn't mention earlier when talking about what we do in DevelopRx. We also have responsibility for Google's open source program office. Open design, open collaboration is core to what we do, core to Google, frankly, being one of the largest contributors to open source across pretty much every area you can think of, including open models like Gemma. And the languages that I mentioned earlier, like Go and Dart and the Flutter framework are all open source. And we have an AI orchestration framework called GenKit that helps application developers bring AI flows into their applications, which is also open source. So it's a big deal to us. It's very important to us. We think that, you know, technology is at its best in impacting the world in the most positive ways when you can have more people that have access to it. When I learned to program at an internship and when I was in high school, the biggest factor that contributed to me learning and getting excited about programming and development was having access to documentation, having the resources and tools provided to me at no charge, where I could learn and experiment and build skills around a set of technology. So I think that that plays out now, and that's very true now. And so we want to make sure that as Google, as a company that has birthed many innovative developer tools over the years, that we're making things openly available as well, so that the community can extend them and take them in directions and help support them in ways that we didn't even think of. I never fail to be amazed at what developers do when they're armed with the tools. They just kind of take it in directions you didn't think of. On the other side of that is like, how do we decide what we don't open source? You know, what you probably wouldn't think of as a big factor for us when weighing whether we open source something or not is whether or not we can support the community as well as they need us to support them. You know, the worst thing is when we open source something, the project just languishes, doesn't get much support, the community is opening issues, we're not able to respond or, you know, help implement them, or even if they want to fully implement them, we're not able to partner on our side to take on those changes as quickly or as frequently as they need us to. So that's not great for anybody. So just checking the box that we open source something when we couldn't really support the community is not really what we want to do. So that's one of the main major factors in our decision.
I see both the pros and cons for sure. Another question I wanted to ask is, like, what's one myth about being a VP in tech that you'd love to tell our audience about?
I think one myth is that we don't have much to do.
Amazing.
We just, you know, go to meetings, you know, like, what do those people do anyway?
You make me want to be a VP.
I can definitely say, at least for me, that's not true. And my team will definitely tell you that. I think maybe there's also this myth that you should be more high level and not be in the details. You should focus on like managing people or managing teams rather than the products and really shaping them in the direction and the way that they're delivered to our customers. Some of the best leaders are those that are continuously able to shift between having a really broad perspective, but also going really deep. I think that you can be, care about your team and really support the growth of people that you work with on your team. And then also be really focused on the products and the services that you're building, and being able to engage closely with your customers and the developer community in shaping those products and being able to bring them to the world.
One of the things I think you said super important, which kind of like struck a chord in me, was as a VP, you have to know, like, you have to dive deep into some things. You have to kind of like look at things at a higher level. You have to understand like operations, all these different assets. And I think one of the most important things is when to do which, like, when do you know, like, okay, this is something we need to look at from more of a high level. This, when is the time to get into this rabbit hole? And the timing for that can make all the difference. You also mentioned Gemma. So talking a little bit about Gemma, you gave the developer keynote at Google I/O. And I believe you also traveled to Berlin to announce tools like the Gemma 2 model. So for our audience, whoever doesn't know what Google I/O is, it's one of the company's biggest events for developers who use Google tools to power essentially everything from websites to mobile apps. Want to know, like, what was it like delivering the keynote and launching tools like Gemma 2 on that stage?
Wow, a lot happens when prepare for I/O, and I have to give credit to our amazing team and vendor partners who helped pull off such a huge event. And it's an important event because it's the time that we try to share our point of view about where technology is headed and how Google is innovating to help people's lives every day. I just get to represent everyone when I do things like that. I'm not someone who likes to prepare too much for speaking or presentations. You know, for things like that, you can imagine there is some amount of preparation that goes into it. But I don't enjoy or feel comfortable doing something unless I'm just me doing it. Mm-hmm. I prepare just enough to know what am I talking about, but I don't prepare so much that everything I'm saying is actually scripted. So I'm well known amongst our event team and our product team for not sticking to scripts and saying what just comes to me in that moment. That makes it more fun, I think. You know, I had a blast working with the team on Gemma. And I think for me personally, I found it just pretty cool that Google Bing, you know, was really the first to offer both models like Gemini, and now we're on the latest 2.5 Pro and 2.5 Flash, which are just amazing in terms of performance on the leaderboards. But then also introducing open models like Gemma, and now being with Gemma 3, and then you just introduced Dolphin Gemma. It's just like amazing to see all of this innovation. And so, yeah, like I said earlier, I'm just grateful to be part of it.
AI native IDEs, you know, like Cursor, or in a sense, redefining developer experience with, you know, intelligence and like real-time assistance. But in big tech, we obviously know that code really can't leave like the VPC, right? The parameter. And so there's a real tension between, okay, like power and privacy. And so since you're leading, you know, DevX at Google, how do you approach I guess, building tools that match the level of intelligence, but while keeping everything on-prem.
So, I don't know if I've contrasted those two angles. I think that often what we hear from organizations is a sense of like, how do we govern what we provide to developers, but also unleash their creativity and provide them the best tools, the best models that we can. And so I think that those two things don't have to be at odds with each other. I think the proof is that many of these tools, you mentioned Cursor, WinSurf, I mentioned Firebase Studio earlier. We also have our Gemini Code Assist solution that integrates with many of the popular IDEs like VS Code. And so I think that we see that it's actually paying off, that putting these tools and putting the best models into developers' hands really unleashes their creativity. And at the same time, we're working with companies on how do we make the governance model appropriate for this new world where you want those two things to fuse together. And so there's like questions of compliance and privacy, you know, how do I protect my intellectual property with my code bases and the sensitive information that's important to us. And so you mentioned VPCs, that's definitely really important that companies can kind of keep things as part of their virtual private cloud. But at the same time, we're partnering with other companies so that these things can be made available where the developers are and where companies need it to be available. So for example, you can use Gemini with other IDEs. You can use, you know, Gemini Code Assist with other IDEs. On the back end of that, we can still help organizations think about their governance models. So it's an evolving space. I think that there's going to be more to come. Every year, we're making leaps in not only the tools that we can make available, but the approach that we can help companies to protect their businesses while, you know, making things creative and free for developers to try.
Now, I feel like if you don't code with an AI guiding you, it's kind of like you're wasting your time, like move faster. But what parts of this development process do you still believe needs human touch?
I think software development needs human touch.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the thing, right? For a long time now, decades upon decades, we've had technology helping to augment what people can do. But it hasn't like taken away our role in our own lives and in work. And so I think that we will continue to see AI advance. We now see amazing power with AI agents in the software development lifecycle, being able to perform tasks like helping you be able to look at how your application is using and calling inference, and then being able to run adversarial tests to see that if your application is using AI safely. For example, is one of the AI agents we introduced recently in private preview with Gemini Code Assist agents. And, you know, other agents that are helping you with reviewing pull requests on your repo and being able to work on those requests and be able to document what they did. And then if humans need to be in the loop, being able to open up tasks for humans to complete and block on those tasks or continue with the next request. So we're seeing AI agents being woven in and participating in the software development lifecycle. I think that's going to increase. I think the question is, will you have like a spawn of many, many, many different types of specialized agents, or will you have sort of this Uber supervisor agent that can supervise many other agents, but be sort of the main orchestrator, if you will. And then I think as you have more AI agents in the software development lifecycle, it becomes important in enabling these agents to work together, just like people and teams work together on software projects. And so how do you enable agents to work not only together with other agents, but then be able to work together with people as part of teams? And so I think we're going to go from right now looking at AI agents mostly as tools or automations in processes that are dependent on human judgment to agents that can have a certain degree of autonomy and judgment as well, and becoming a full-fledged members of these our development teams.
Do you think we'll get to a point where AI engineers will basically 100% replace human software engineers? So currently, like you've said, right, we've seen startups come up with, you know, agents that are very specialized, right? So an AI that can, you know, review your code and suggest improvements. I don't know, an AI that can stress test your product. Agents that are being able to work in a team will come up very, very soon, in my opinion. What happens when AIs can solve the conflict resolution problem?
I happen to think that there are certain things that don't change. Maybe I'll be wrong, but I think it's a high chance that a few things won't change. For example, the applications that we all like to use, I like to use in my life, you like to use in your life, or that we use in our jobs. Those applications continue to have non-functional requirements. You still need security. You want them to perform well. You can't accept latency that is too high. And it's even more true for latency sensitive applications. You have user experiences that need to hit a certain quality or consistency with your brand and with your values as a brand. So there's a whole set of things that you still need to be able to serve. For example, you're going to market in many countries where they each have different jurisdictions and compliance and regulations. How do you make sure your applications are adaptive enough and satisfying those different requirements?
So through your journey from zero to the one that you are today, what is the most valuable lesson you've learned and how has it shaped your path?
What I would say, I think the best stuff happens when you're focused on helping others be great. When you're more focused on yourself, you don't actually achieve the best version of yourself. When you're more focused on helping others be great and achieve things together with others, that's when you unlock something that's really special.
Thank you so much, Janine. We had an amazing time.
It was amazing meeting you. Thanks, Janine.
Thank you both, Ashna and Ryan. It is great to meet you as well. I hope that your audience has a lot of fun and finds some useful nuggets in our conversation.
Yes, for sure.